mark the beginning of the new school year for many of the families of St. Paul's, and also for the rest of us whose lives are greatly influenced by the church, the school calendar somehow. In honor of this, I'm going to begin my sermon this morning with a little grammar review. Don't worry, really it's more of a grammar confession. While I basically performed well in school, I think I must have slept through the instruction on grammar during elementary and middle school. I know my nouns, I know my verbs, I know my prepositional phrases, but beyond that, I think I just went with my own little rule to write or say whatever sounded right. Somehow, I was just liberated from the constraints of learning all those grammar rules. What's amazing is that going by my rule of sticking with what sounded right served me pretty well most of my life. Well enough, that is, until I went to seminary. There, I attempted to study biblical Greek and was confronted with things called aorist and pluperfect verbs. They have something to do with the past, I don't know, asked Dr. Burris after the service. And professors routinely begged us seminarians to not split our infinitives, which I just did on purpose, just to see you teachers and grammar geeks flinch. Reading our Old Testament lesson for today from Isaiah, even a grammar duffer like me can see that something grammatical is going on. And I want to understand its purpose. There is this repetitive phrasing throughout the passage. Pull out the text from your service leaflet or grab the Bible in front of you and open it to Isaiah 58. In the passage, verses 9b through 12 start with a couple of ifs. If you remove the yoke, if you offer your food, and then the text supplies a quick then your light shall rise, the Lord will guide you continually, you shall be like a watered garden, your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt, and you shall be called the repairer and restorer. This pattern is repeated in verses 13 and 14 also. If you refrain from trampling the Sabbath, if you call the Sabbath a delight, if you honor it, then you shall take delight in the Lord and ride upon the heights and be fed like our ancestors. Now, you clever grammarians out there already know that this if-then thing is called a conditional clause or sentence. Conditional clauses start with the word if or unless and express either a factual or hypothetical situation and then the consequences of it. If this, then that. Now, in writing this sermon, examples of conditional sentences began to flood my memory banks, and I heard the voices of my parents saying things like, Sharon, if you eat your peas, then you will have dessert. If you do your homework, then you may go over to your friend's house. And my personal favorite, Sharon, if you stick things in your ears, then we will have to take you to the doctor's office to have them removed. Maybe it's just me. But these conditional clauses in Isaiah bring to mind a parent pointing out consequences of my decisions and of my behavior. But God doesn't love us conditionally any more than my parents did. So let's look at what's behind this passage and the use of this literary tool. Our Old Testament reading today is from the final portion of Isaiah, when the Jews have returned from exile in Babylon to Jerusalem. And it's not the glorious homecoming they expected. They are suffering economic hardship and conflict within their community, a stark contrast to the glowing vision of how life would be when they returned home. While all are experiencing difficulty, there seems to be some among them who are being selfish and even oppressing others. This chapter in Isaiah is speaking of a course correction that the people need to make. Through the use of these conditional clauses, God is signaling to the people that there is hope and salvation, not condemnation, but that it requires them to maintain God's justice and do what's right. Do what's right for those within the community and do what's right through proper worship and respect for the Sabbath. There are positive consequences for following God's ordinances. True righteousness is found through weaving together good relations with one another, caring for those in need, and Sabbath observance, not in looking out for their own interests or taking action guided by what is most expedient. Now, if we shift our attention to today's gospel reading, there seems to be echoes of similar conditional clauses in this passage as well. The synagogue leader protests Jesus' healing action taken on the Sabbath. "This is work," he proclaims, "and it disrespects God's ordinance of ceasing work on the Sabbath. If you break the Sabbath, then you're in big trouble." The synagogue leader seems to take the gift of the law and turn it into a rule book, measuring Jesus and finding him out of compliance. But that's not how God intended the law to be applied, especially the law of the Sabbath. Jesus points out to the synagogue that if you can untie an ox or a donkey on the Sabbath, then surely on the Sabbath you can untie a daughter of Abraham bound up by a crippling ailment. Yes, he outwitted the synagogue leader, but Jesus isn't overturning the law or attacking observance of the Sabbath. No, he is returning to the original purpose of the Sabbath. The Sabbath was not meant to enslave the people. It was meant to liberate the people. God gave the children of Israel the Sabbath to remind them in Sinai that they were no longer slaves in Egypt, with taskmasters who required them to work 7 days a week. Instead, they were free people, no longer commodities deployed for the sole purpose of endless production in the service of a command economy, as Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann describes it. The children of Israel needed to be reminded of this purpose as they struggled after their return to Jerusalem from exile, just as centuries later, the synagogue leader and his cronies needed to be reminded by Jesus of God's liberating purpose of the Sabbath. And we too need to be reminded of this message of liberation today. With families re-entering yet another school year with all of its busyness, early morning alarm clocks, rushing off to carpools or to meet buses, after-school activities, sports, homework, it's easy to fall into a sense of mere survival as we attempt to keep up with all of the production required by the command economy of schooling and education. God wants more for us than mere survival. God wants us to thrive and to flourish. How can you and your family engage in the demands of the school year without becoming enslaved by its schedule? For those of us without school-age children and without the demands of a school year, what does this message of liberation mean for us? What enslaves us? Is it fear of our future, whether the balance and performance of our IRAs will be enough for us to have a comfortable retirement? Is it concern for our health or the health and well-being of our loved ones? Is it that the rules that we live by, worship by, are all being shifted and changed before our very eyes? God longs for us to be liberated from whatever it is that binds or enslaves us, whether it is our schedules, our fears, our responsibilities, our dislike for change or innovation. What is it that keeps you from experiencing the liberating life that is ours through Jesus Christ? If you can look fearlessly at your life and figure out what that is, then the consequence is, as Isaiah proclaims to us, our light shall rise in the darkness, the Lord will guide us and satisfy our needs, and we will take delight in the Lord, renewed, refreshed, restored, and liberated from all that binds us. Thanks be to God.